The title is an overview of the ecovariance technique in the agricultural and environmental applications. You can actually apply ecovariance really in any kind of ag research. And this conference is more based than anything on the ag research. Why do we bother to start with ecovariance at all? Well, scientists are clever people, right? So they claim that about 50% of CO2 is dissipating into the oceans. I have tendency to trust them, even though I still didn't see complete evidence of that claim. But the other 50%, we really don't know exactly how it goes and where it goes. And that's what is the purpose of the ecovariance method. To try to quantify those ecosystem exchanges, interestial ecosystems. That's what I try to focus when I'm helping my customers on how to design the system which would fit their needs the best. And it's really not an easy task sometimes to do. You need to think of a lot of things. First, you need to start on where you can basically measure all of this stuff. So this graph shows you exactly the atmosphere profile of the atmosphere boundary layer, and that one is usually about 300 meters high. You are allowed, though, to measure the eddy covariance in only 10% of it, in the surface layer, right? If you go higher than that, you will enter into the regional properties, and that can really mess up your data. So you have some boundaries there. From the bottom, you can't go too low. From the top, you can't go too high. There is the magic height you can be at. That's what, you know, a lot of people trying to figure out. We have some rule of thumbs to follow, and that's what I follow mostly with my customers when they ask over the phone, what do you think, you know, in my specific application, what would be the best way to go? So I use this Van Gogh's Starry Night picture, just nice one, but it really depicts pretty well the eddies out there. You can imagine them going all over the place. Some of them are very small, but very fast. They carry really a little amount of information, but if you imagine them going all of them together, that amount of information adds up pretty quickly. So you need to be able to catch them. You also need to go and handle those slow pokes, the big ones. They are slow, so you have time to catch them. However, they really bring a lot of information with them, so you don't want to miss them either. So you need to find the method, you need to find the way to catch all of this stuff there in this messy world and get the measurements done in the proper way. And this presentation is more designed to be approaching the beginners. So you guys who really know all of this stuff, turn on your MP3 players and relax for next 30 minutes. I will need your help at the end because I would like to call for some discussion here. That's why I will try to finish a little bit earlier with this. So if we imagine this arbitrary field as a box, you know, and if we, you know, kind of want to make the net ecosystem exchange calculation there, the stuff which comes into this box is storage. Then we have advective term and the turbulent term we need to take care of. Now, for the eddy covariance applications, we really want to go away from the advective term because that one is corrupting our data. We need to have all of this stuff governed or ran by the eddies, right? That is the stuff we are interested in. The storage, however, is a big component of it. So this is the pretty nasty mathematical formula, right, which Bill Massman deals all the time with, and he loves that kind of stuff. I don't, but I like to break down to something really friendly to my eyes. So all of this stuff here, what I would worry about is the turbulent transport, which I need to measure as best as I can. And then, if I have opportunity, I can take care of the storage term. Because that one can really mess me up at the end if I don't know exactly what is going on. Advective transport, again, if all the assumptions are met for the eddy covariance application, should be eliminated, shouldn't be there. So what are the assumptions? We have that the measurement A or measurement at the point A, let's say our tower, where we want to put the tower, should be representative of the entire area. Well, that's really easy to say in theory, but it's not that easy to find in practice. You are dealing with natural fields. They are not all indefinitely big. They are not all indefinitely flat. They have a lot of stuff there which will make you headaches. So you will need to go around and sketch out your field and see exactly what would be the best point there which can really represent your area and in the same time fulfill all of these assumptions. Like the next one, which is that you need to be inside of the boundary layer. So you can't go all the way up there, because if you go very, very high up, you will enter into the regional properties, you will corrupt your data, and you need to have pretty large field. How big? I will touch that in a minute on what is the rule of thumb, how to determine how big the field should be. Footprint, connected to the previous one. So we need to find the good one, the field which will represent us and be big enough. If we can't find this, and sometimes we really cannot, we just need to move away and find similar sites somewhere else. In very specific situations, you could fit your eddy covariance system into the limited field, but you will need to do a lot of data filtering. So if that's something what you really need to do, that's the only tool left for you to do. As I said, all the vertical fluxes do need to be done by eddies, so any kind of advection of the or the vertical movement of the air should be eliminated, because that will introduce errors in your flux calculations. The instrumentation is a very big part of it. I work for the instrumentation company, and we try to do the best to make the best sensors to meet your needs. And really, since LIKOR did the wonderful job first introducing the LI7500 about 12, 13 years ago, open pad gas analyzer, the good news appeared. So from that moment, we did have the sensor which can technically do the measurements for you. Our sonic anemometer, CC3, was the turbulent part of it, which does the job for you. So when we married the two, when we were in a pretty happy marriage for a while, LIKOR and us, we really, I think, tried to make our customers happy, and we helped them to do all of this stuff. We haven't been perfect. We are not perfect today, but we are trying to get and listen your feedback to get this stuff done as best as we can. The last assumption here is, of course, no vertical movement, or basically flat field out there, in order to meet all of this stuff. So you can start doing something fun with the eddy covariance. So if all of these assumptions are met, then this nasty mathematical stuff kind of gets a little simpler. We can kind of neglect this one, right, the vertical movement. And we can basically now think of the two restovers, the storage and the turbulent transport, or the eddy covariance, right? So let's focus now a little bit on the how we got there to get these measurements done. Chemical Scientific is around for about now 30 years. Our specialty is making data loggers. We are, I would say, pretty good in that. Now, our old one and little older guys here know the CR5. That one was the first one which was used in a kind of an eddy covariance application together with CA27, our 2D sonic, which was fast enough to do the 2D flux in that time, coupled with our krypton hygrometer. KH20 is around still. We did not change a thing on it since 1985 when it was first introduced. We are not selling it that high like we did before, of course, because now LIKOR's LI7500 came along. We now also came with our own open pad gas analyzing systems for the CO2 and water. LIKOR did the methane. So we have some other flavors now. But the KH20 was the first eddy covariance instrument, fast responsive instrument for the water fluxes. And if you are after the water flux, that guy does really good job, even today. So if you want it, you can get it. And it's fairly cheap compared to all the other infrared gas analyzers still, and it's out there for us to use. Feedback from customers throughout the years, except of a pretty harsh babysitting, is pretty good. So I wouldn't recommend this guy if you need to be in the middle of nowhere, leave the site for 10 days or so without checking how it's going, if you don't have any modem there to call in and check. I wouldn't leave it because it does need a little bit more of the Windows cleaning. It's working on the krypton hygrometry method, so it does need a little bit more babysitting. So if you can't afford babysitting at the field, don't go with this one. In 1993, so 20 years ago now, we started together with the University of Guelph, the great guys there, the collaboration on development of TGA-100s, of our trace gas analyzing systems, which was our introduction into the gas business to start with. Then we started to work also with LICOR together on development of the open patch system. So LI-7500 was a bit of a collaborative effort together with this great company from Lincoln. 96, the time when we actually got finally around our CSAT-3, the 3D sonic anemometer. And I can tell you since that date, we didn't change anything on it yet. We are doing some little changes, though, as we speak. However, the geometry of the sensor is pretty okay for the most of terrestrial applications out there, for the eddy-covariance application, and this sensor really performs well. Bill had the talk the other day on some problems in some cases, and we are looking into those, but those are more, I would address those more to a specific terrain conditions than these all perfect stuff which you need to meet in order to do a good eddy-covariance measurement goes away. Then you need to do a little bit of other digging to find the modifications which would work for you the best. We are open for discussion, and that's what I will do at the end also on the sensors, and we can always talk on some changes. That's what we need to do all the time for our customers, right? 99, LI-7500, as I said, that was a big news for the eddy world because finally we got one open patch sensor out there, and that guy worked beautifully. I was a grad student at the time when it was introduced, had 6 stations running, and I didn't really have too much trouble. So, LICOR, thank you for that. That was a very good experience for me. And then I was lucky enough to support the sensor as a engineer in Campbell's for quite a few years before we came out with our own EC150 open pet gas analyzer. What was the reason to go there? Push from the community to get something which would be collocated or as close to the sonic as possible so we can really measure the same volume of the air at the same time. So EC150 was the mid-step to the final one. We got this gas analyzer designed a little bit. It looks different. It looks like some kind of a spacecraft to me. We got it designed so it can really marry well with our CSAT-3. In the same time, community was really after reliable close-pad systems. And we were doing the race, kind of dead race, between us and LICOR at that time. So LICOR came out with I-7200. We came out with our CPEC 200 system. The closed pad systems have their advantages, and I will touch them in a minute, for some specific applications, and that's why we try to go that route as well. We had few flavors of the closed pad systems through years, but they were kind of clunky. They were pretty unfriendly for the end user to use. And a lot of them, as the TGAs were not working very well with the AC-powered systems. They needed main power there. And you can't have it all the time. So we need to go and find something which would really fit the instrument's needs of our customers. That's why we came up with CPEC 200. And then the final result of all of this stuff was the Ergoson, which we introduced last year. It's completely collocated sensor. CSAT-3 completely coupled with EC 150 or the ERGA there. Name, I don't know if I was ever happy with the name at the end, but it's kind of fun to say Ergason to me now. I kind of got used to it. So customers, I guess, don't complain too much. It sounds a little Japanese to me, which is great. And our Japanese guys told me that it's not at least offensive. So there you go. We can live with that, right? So what are the advantages of the OpenPath? That's what I get a lot of questions over the phone when customers ask me. First of all, I would say they are really easy to maintain. Good ones, like Lycor's system is and our system. You don't really need too much of the babysitting there. You will need to clean the windows here and there. You have the dust accumulation. You will have rain running into the path, right? You will lose the signal then. But beside that, after the obstacle is out of the optical part, either of the sonic or the infrared gas analyzer, you should be back to business. You should be running. They really don't need much of power anymore. Some of them a little bit more, some of them less. However, they can run out of solar panels and batteries, which was a big requirement from our users to have these kind of systems. They can also have they have great frequency response. And I will in a minute touch this term a little bit more in depth for the guys who are not thinking about it all the way through. It's not the same as the sample rate. And there is no tube delays here, so you don't really need to worry to do any corrections on that with the OpenPath systems. Closed-path systems do have their own advantages as well. The first and the biggest one, I would say, is that they can have at least our CPEC 200 has an automated span or zero end span for the CO2, and it can be done for the water as well. Some people can immediately jump and say, well, that's advantage, are you sure? That's to me looking very annoying and very busy and work intensive thing. I think it is advantage. If you have it automated, like our logger can control all of this stuff, you can really be on top of your calibration of your sensors at all times, so your readings will be accurate, right? They do perform better under the rain conditions. At least the gas part does, because it's enclosed. It's enclosed inside of an enclosure. The air is pumped into it, right? So you are not exposed to the environmental conditions exactly. So if you think, you know, you will work in the area where you will have a lot of rain, I would think going with a closed path system probably. You will probably need to get some good array of solar panels and batteries to get you there, but you can do it now. They can be now AC powered or DC powered. That our focus was on to have them capable to be ran on the solar panels, and we got there, so they can be running like that. And our CPEC 3 does have, if compared with the other OpenPath sensors except Ergason, has a better flow distortion when it's close to the anemometer. Our CPEC 200 also has a very good frequency response for a closed path system. It's about 5 hertz, which is fairly enough, and I will show you later a little calculation there on what the requirements are. And if you need more information, I have a few of the handouts down in the booth on this, or you can find it online following this link. Let's try now to talk just a little bit on the quality assurance of the data, how you go and make sure that all of this stuff which you work hard on will actually pay off for you, and you know that you are doing the good data collection, that you are doing a good job. The first thing would be to touch on the momentum flux or the intensity of turbulence. As we said, turbulence is the main driver of eddy covariance application. If you don't have it, you don't have the eddy covariance measurement at all. So check your turbulence intensity at all times. We have this pre-programmed in our open-path systems or closed-path systems, so it's output there every 30 minutes, for example. And I'm sure that Lycor system does the same. check on that. They can be, the threshold is anywhere between 0.1 to 0.5 meters per second. That would be the minimum of the movement before everything really falls apart. I would strongly suggest, though, run your own test and make sure that you know your site really well, because if you determine the threshold properly, then you will know exactly when is the what is the level where you can cut off the data and say, you know, this is too quiet, I can't count for it. So let's talk a little bit on the sample rate versus frequency response. And let me share a little, I mean, just experience from the phone stories I get from customers on the phone. They call up and they say, I need to have a data logger which can run really fast. Sure, we have that one. How fast do you want to go? I want to go 100 hertz. Wonderful. They have the data logger. Can do the 100 hertz, right? And they, I go, you know, why do you need to go that fast? And they go, well, I know, I will run an eddy covariance system. Oh, really? And you want to go at 100 hertz with eddy covariance system? You know, and they go like, you think I shouldn't? I'm like, well, I think you probably shouldn't. You can. You will run your data logger at 100 hertz. Sensors, they don't probably run that fast. CSAT3 cuts off about 60 hertz. Likert 7500, if I remember correctly, somewhere between 50 and 60. Our EC150 or Ergoson, 50 or 60 hertz. But that's plenty enough. That's 50 times a second. What is the terrestrial ecosystem out there which really responds to that kind of change? That's what I always ask. So it's not the same. Sample rate is not the same as the frequency response of your system. There is little calculation there which you can make based on this dimensionless n coefficient. If you assume that one is 10, and that's very, very conservative assumption, the practical part shows that this can go significantly down to at least half. But if we assume that that one is 10, then if we plug in this little equation here for the measurement height and wind speed, then you can quickly see what about the frequency response of the terrestrial ecosystem comes to, right? So if you are at 2.5 meters of height with your instrumentation, which I believe from the experience shared from my own research and from customers I talked with, that's like the height which is most common out there. The frequency response at 2.5 meters per second, which is just nice breeze, right, is about 10 hertz. So yeah, you need 10 hertz for that. So if you are this low, you will need to go at least at 10 hertz to sample, right? If the wind speed goes up to 10 meters per second, which is pretty unpleasant feeling wind already, then yeah, you are up there to 40 hertz. So if you are sampling at 10 hertz, you will miss some of those really fast eddies. But how often this high wind speed is out there? What is the error there? So you just need to kind of think about that relationship. I would say if you are low, if you need to be lower down, like anywhere from 1.5 meters of height, which is considered as about minimum height for an eddy covariance application, to anyway to like 5 to 6 meters of height, you are okay sampling at 20 hertz. Your frequency response will be fine. You will get all of the information you need. As you can see, if you go up with the height, the frequency response goes down. Even at the really high wind speeds, you are only at about 3.3 hertz, right? So as you go higher up, your frequency response goes down. You just see those very slow pokey ones, very slow eddies, which they really bring a lot of information, and you will get almost all of it there. Quality control continued. What do you need to do? What I think is the best approach, and this is my personal, I think it's though pretty accepted in the scientific community, is to go and divide your data set into the two of them, into the daytime and nighttime. Why? Because the nighttime always sucks. You will find that out. That closure will bring you down fast. So you need to divide in order to get yourself really happy. What do you do with the daytime data? You need to first of all determine the range of the tolerance. So the U star or the intensity of turbulence would be the first thing I would pay attention to. Then you need to flag your data for precipitation. Precipitation will mess you up. When the raindrops go into the path of the sensors, you will at least lose the signal for that moment, or if not longer, like if the windows get wet, it will take some time for them to dry off on the infrared gas analyzers. We do slope them. We do a lot of things, tricks there to try to shed that water out as quick as possible, but it just doesn't go all the way that quickly, so it will stay for a while there. Just be aware of it. So you will face some problems there. However, you should be closing your eddy covariance daytime data at about 90%, I would say, at all times. If you are closing lower than 80%, something doesn't work for you. It's probably the location of the site. It's probably the height of your instrumentation. Maybe you are too high. Maybe you are too low. I would go then revisit. But if you are anywhere from 80 to 90 or above, I would be pretty comfortable. Now, people jump immediately on and say, what on earth is going on? Why are we losing 10% out there in the best possible condition? Well, it's a lot of reasons, and I will touch some of them. However, if you publish your data with 100% closure at all times, right, that will look a little fishy. Because you don't have perfect conditions in the field all times. To close at 100%, you need to have wonderful sunny day, really good breezy day, and strong fluxes all the time. That will close you at 100%. If that's not there, and it's not there all the time, you will not close at 100%. You have something which pulls you down. Usually, first thing which pulls you down is just the turbulence intensity. It's just not active enough to really bring all of the stuff at the point where you are, where you look. It's going by you, either under or really high above there. So that's what you miss usually. That's what I think messes you up the most. Sometimes your sensors misbehave. Your net radiation sensor gets scrapped from something out there, and you get your net radiation messed up. That's a big portion of your total flux there, right? So that's the stuff usually you need to take care of. The nighttime data, what is not problem there? It's a lot of stuff you face there. You have very low turbulence, if any. At least you have a low turbulence for the part of the night, in many cases for the whole night. Well, if that's the case, you just can't do anything about it. With the eddy covariance instrumentation, you need to go and look into something more, and I will touch that in a minute. There is no radiation, which is the biggest component, right, in the energy balance equation. So the nighttime is the problem. The biggest problem, I would say, during the night is the storage. So that would be thing to focus on, to try to understand what is going on during the night, what you can't see up on this level where you measure with your eddy covariance instrumentation. Something could crawl down under, and you just don't see it. It's nothing there. It's not enough turbulence there to bring the stuff up so you can see it. So that's what it is. Fluxes are too small. You have stable conditions, and we will touch at the end the stability of the atmosphere. Plays a big role in eddy covariance technique. But the storage, I think, is pretty significant. So that's the energy balance closure, right? So we strive to be at 100%, of course. Now, as I said, we will not be there all the time. So let's see a little bit on this storage term. We are trying to go more into it. We tried more than 10 years ago developing the TGA systems, doing some other stuff besides the CO2 and water, like methane and nitrous oxide and CO2 isotopes, and so on and so forth. But unfortunately, we are not able to right now run with TGAs anymore because laser company cuts us off. Who is making the lasers? So we were just too low on their list of buyers. you know, this stuff is not that popular like cell phones are, or whatever they, you know, or anything, or some other optical instrumentation out there which is mass production. So they just cut us off. We can't do them right now. We are looking into some solutions there. We were doing special profiling systems for a while, but that's kind of like on a trial basis. You do one thing, you get it out to customers, and you wait for their feedback. So that's how the profiling systems were developed through the years. Finally, last year, we did a final version of it called AP200, and I think it's pretty nice. We are using for this profiling system Licor's 840 analyzer, the water and CO2 analyzer. This is the application which does not need fast, super fast, responsive analyzer. That's why LI840 does wonderful job there. You don't need super fast response because that system doesn't have that frequency response during the night that fast, right? You just need to sample at fairly often on different heights and know exactly what the concentrations are there so you can quantify that storage term and get that information, which you can plug into the energy balance and improve it during the night, right? The black area here is basically the area what you measure, the measurement area, right? That surface flux stable layer, right? And this is the picture from the book, the Stahl's book from 1998. This is the Utah, typical Utah winter. We live in Logan in Cache Valley, and this is a picture taken from the top of one of the mountains. And this is the nice stuff you see down there when you look from the top of the mountain. And here, down there, somewhere under there, this is the picture taken when it was one of the better days. But that white stuff turns yellow pretty quickly. And then doesn't look that good, and it doesn't feel that good, trust me. We get so stable conditions there. There is no mixture in the air whatsoever. And then you just try, you know, start to accumulate all of that nice stuff, and that nice stuff changes the color to the pretty bad color, you know, and then you are just hoping to get something, some turbulence there, something to move that stuff out. So we just look forward to every weather forecast so it can move us and get us going on again. So eddy covariance systems, and this is the stuff which I wanted to explain here quickly. The blue line basically is the line which is the actual CO2 flux. The black line, and I don't know how well you can see there, that's the line which is measured with the EC system. If you follow, and I know if I can get the mouse here, I think I can. Okay. So if you follow this, you will see that what we miss in the morning, we kind of get back in the evening. So with time, that's the assumption. Turbulence will come out there. It will pick up all the properties that at the end, you know, in the 24-hour period, you will basically be kind of at the same level. You will get all the information at the end. Is that always the case? I would say probably no. That's why I think you need to go and do the profiles. Why? Because you can have a stratification which will decouple you. You will have advection going on which can really drain that stuff away and you will not see it. I think all of this stuff is the cause of the problem with energy balance closure and the quality of the data during the night time or during the low turbulence time. So let's just at the end touch quickly on the real field installation, where, how, recommendations there. This picture was taken many years ago in China. This is over the very high tower in China there. You can see that the surface doesn't look very uniform down. You have some patches of grassland and some forest there. But this tower, it was really high, about 50, 60 meters there. But you can still do this eddy covariance measurement. Now, if you go like, wait, he said at the beginning that the surface stable layer is about 30 meters high, so how come you can go higher than that? There is a special situation when you have higher vegetation, then you can account for some zero plane displacement, so-called, to some correction where you can go above that, and I will explain that a little bit more at the very end. So our tower needs to be located so it's really representing the area you want to measure it over, right? Footprint needs to be big enough to cover all of this stuff. As I said, easier said than done. Most often than not, you will not have perfect field size. Sometimes you will be forced to be in the corner of the field, and you will just be able to measure the fluxes coming to you from one direction only, where you have the field size. Other, the wind directions, you will just need to cut off. You will just need to filter them out. So you will need to face that kind of problem. Rule of thumb here, how high you go with your sensors. For every meter of height of the sensors, you need to have 100 meters ahead of you. That's the rule of thumb, which works pretty nicely. So just remember, for every meter of height, 100 meters of edge, preferably all around you, right? If nothing else, at least towards the predominant wind. Contribution of the flux. This is about 2 meters of height here depicted, right? And we have 200 meters of field in front of us. You can see that the majority comes about from the half of this field. So when you are installing your tower, you can see that the contribution down here is almost zero. Of course, that's great, because you can't fly around the tower and install it, right? You need to walk there and do the stuff. You need to maintain your tower. You can do that freely because the contribution is really not that big there, but it climbs up pretty quickly. So don't walk out there. Don't drive in your field with your vehicles. You know, people go, oh, I need to walk, you know, 300 meters to my field. Let me just go drive, you know. Don't, because you will corrupt your field site, and then you will get crappy results. If you want to have it representative, then leave it as intact as possible. All the soil stuff, you know, for the energy balance components, I would install where it's representative. And in some cases, you will need to, you know, go in there, but try to limit walks through as much as you can when you are installing those sensors. You don't corrupt your field too much. Surface roughness is very important. If you have rougher surface, you can go higher with your sensors with a shorter field. Rougher surface shrinks the footprint. Smoother surface extends your footprint. So just be aware of that. That's the take-home message. So if you have brushes, if you have land and stuff, that is pretty rough surface. You can go higher, right? To even out those imperfections, but your field is shorter, your contributions are shorter around, so you will not have to have very, very, very large fields. But if you have very smooth field, then you'll need to be lower, and you will your footprint really, really, really will grow out there. So that's connected basically, sensor height and roughness. Always think of the you can go higher with rougher, lower. You need to go lower when you are smoother. Zero plane displacement, I already mentioned it. It's a 2/3 of the obstacle. So if your forest is like 30 meters high, your start point would be at about 20 meters from the ground surface up, right? So that's why you can go significantly higher up there when you have forest applications. You can have the higher towers, and you need to have the higher towers. The roughness length is also one of the components to look at. You can see the information on the slide. I wouldn't spend too much time for it. It's very small for the smooth surfaces. It could be up to 1 meter for the very rough surfaces. So that's not that big. Big of a deal when you are doing the sensor installation there. Stable atmospheres, very stable atmosphere will stretch your field, right? So you need to have really big fields when you have stable atmosphere. You can have pretty small fields when you have unstable atmosphere. When do you have all the time stable and all the time unstable? Never. You always have mixture there. It will always change. So you need to count on some kind of a neutral ground. That's what we call neutral atmosphere, right? And that's what the rule of thumb for the fetch size is applying. So for every meter of height of the sensor, you go 100 meters of the fetch. That would be applicable for the neutral atmosphere. To conclude this, I wanted to say a few observations which I noticed through the years talking with customers on the phone is we need to improve the energy balance. It does bother me, as everybody here, that we cannot do better than about 90% when we average out, and I would like to have that number higher by any means. What is out there, what we need to do to be there, that's what I would like to maybe hear in a few minutes left here from you guys, what you think is the best way to do this. I hear from customers more and more questions on the sloped applications. As I said, you do not have all the time perfect situation in the field. There is the time when you need to work on the sloped fields. What is that involving? Bill did already touch on some problems with sonics in these situations. There is probably something more there which we would like to know about. Urban applications, the ecovariance urban applications, totally unknown field to me, and I'm getting all the time calls about it, and go, you know what? I really don't know much. That's very new stuff. I don't know how to deal with the field size there, because you don't have a field. You have a city in front of you. It's not a field. And it's really growing. This kind of application is getting more and more popular. A lot of funding put towards it, as well as marine applications. Even though scientists say 50% of CO2 is dissipating into the oceans, is it really true? Let's try, you know, that would be something which I would like to quantify. So that's one of things we need to also look at. That's my opinion. So thank you so much for your attention, guys. And now, take with your questions.
Yeah, we have a